So, about 3 weeks ago, my wife and I celebrated our 10th wedding anniversary, and it gave me cause to remember the speech I gave at the reception. A very close friend of our family had lent us a magnificent vintage Rolls Royce, which my wife used to arrive at the chapel. And so I said in my speech, I thanked him profusely, and I said I'd really like to return the favour, and that if he ever had need for a semi-corroded Citroen ZX hatchback, you know, I would lend it to him any day. And so the reason I remember that today is that almost exactly a year ago, David Weinberg came to visit us in London at the Nature office there, and gave a great, great talk. David is of course the Rolls Royce of web speakers. I nearly said vintage Rolls Royce, and that would have got me in trouble. Whereas I am the white and rust coloured European hatchback by comparison. But I'm really grateful for David and Erica to invite me here, and really looking forward to sharing some of my ideas with you. So as David said, I work at the at Nature Publishing Group. I'm director of web publishing, and my job really in a nutshell is to try and make the most of the web as a scientific communication medium. So in talking about what the web means for science, if you ask almost any publisher, almost any science publisher, and also some scientists, they will answer with two words: open access. That's what the web means for science. That's what a lot of people are focused on, particularly in the publishing industry. This slide summarizes more or less what I'm going to say about it today. Nothing. I don't really intend to say a lot about open access, but perhaps I should immediately contradict myself by saying a little bit about why I'm not going to talk about open access. I think open access is incredibly important, but I personally find it relatively uninteresting. I think there are some more exciting, longer-term things going on. That's not to belittle its importance, but just to say that there are some more important, longer-term, more profound trends going on, and I want to describe what some of those things are. And I also mentioned briefly that open access is happening now, and I think contrary to what a lot of people think, it's not really happening through open access journals. It's happening much more now through funder-mandated self-archiving. So particularly the NIH and the Wellcome Trust in the UK are in the process of basically mandating their researchers to archive their content in central their research reports in central repositories, and in that means through those means much of the scientific literature will become openly available. But if publishers are somewhat obsessed by open access, actually scientists on the whole are rather indifferent to it. And when you look at the uptake when the NIH asked their funded researchers to put their papers into PubMed Central, their central repository, they got about a 4% response. We have actually been depositing author manuscripts into PubMed Central on behalf of our authors. So in this case, the authors don't have to upload it. They just have to tell us in response to our question, yes, I would like you to put it there. And we got a 30% response. But that still means that 70% of scientists couldn't actually be bothered to say, yes, I would like you to put my article into the central repository so that everyone can make it available, which I think sort of speaks to the relative indifference or possibly ignorance about exactly what the issues are. I think it's surprising, I think it's quite sad, but that is the reality. So open access is not unimportant, but I think my view on it is that if you focus too narrowly on that as the main issue, what you're effectively saying is the web is a better printing press. It's a really cheap way of shipping PDFs around. And of course, the web is something much more profound, much more different than that. It's something fundamentally new. And so the really interesting thing about the web is not that it's an efficient way to distribute old-style scientific publications. It's because it's something that has the power to actually redefine what scientific publication is and actually to redefine the way that science is done. So let me start by talking about the way that it may redefine scientific publications and the way that it already is doing so in some ways. Since I'm a publisher, it's an obvious place for me to start. The world of scientific communication online is dominated by two big realms: journals and databases. And actually, they don't talk to one another very much. They don't link to one another very much. They don't work together very well. That is slowly being fixed, and we're seeing some examples. I'll give you a couple of examples now of some of the things that we're doing. I mean, just a couple of specific examples to give you a rough idea. So we have a journal called Nature Chemical Biology that links up with PubChem. PubChem is an NIH run repository of chemical structure information. So when we publish a paper in PubChem, we work with the author to get the structures, information about the structures of the chemicals reported there. We deposit them in PubChem, where they're sort of aggregated together with any other information that PubChem has received about that structure. And we provide a link from the paper through to the PubChem record, and equally they provide a link back. So this is just one small way in which we can start to stitch together the journals with the databases. There's another example here. So this is another one of our journals, Nature Structural and Molecular Biology, where we have links into something called First Glance, which is something that's hosted at San Diego Supercomputer Center, and uses a piece of software, an applet called JMOL, to render the 3D structure, and you can sort of manipulate this and view it from any angle, the 3D structure of the proteins and other macromolecules that are described in the journals. So we're kind of slowly beginning to weave the two parts together. Too slowly, in my opinion, but you know, you've got to start somewhere, and we are making some progress. But I think much more profoundly, as journals have moved online, and as they become more structured and there's more interactivity, they're actually, in some senses, becoming databases themselves. Okay, so we start off, you know, the old world, we had the print journal, and then, you know, sort of during the late 90s, we got all that content online, but essentially in a facsimile form, you know, so it looked just like the print journal. And now what we're moving towards more and more is the notion of a scientific article as a structured sort of data entity. So we've got metadata backing up the article. So, you know, trivially, as publishers, we have bibliographic metadata, you know, which journal and which year was it published and so on and so forth. But we've also increasingly getting scientific metadata. So to enable the kind of linking that I just described, you know, we're getting information about which chemical entities are described in this paper, which proteins, which genes, which species, that kind of thing. Again, it's still not enough, but we're starting to get that. And as you get more and more of it, you can not only link out to databases and have them link back to you, you can also provide very specific search functionality. So you can really find it. Find me a paper about this chemical entity and whatever name it happens to use for it. We're also slowly but surely getting more structured data sets associated with papers. So it's still typically true that where we have supplementary information associated with a paper, you know, that might be a PDF or a Word file or something unstructured. It's only useful for displaying to people and not for computers to do anything else with. But increasingly, there are standards like SBML, which is Systems Biology Markup Language, CML, which is Chemical Markup Language, those kinds of standards that are being used to represent scientific information in a structured way. And occasionally, we do get those submitted along with papers. So that's also helping to improve things and helping to improve the amount of structured information. And again, off the back of that, we can provide services to help people find relevant information, and they can do more useful things with it. Also, slowly but surely, we're starting to get more structure within the actual article itself. So in some cases, we're capturing information in line in the text about, you know, this is a gene and it has a particular identifier in, say, the Entrée gene database, an NIH database. And so we can unambiguously identify that within the text, that this is a gene, and give it its ID. We also have, in some cases, we also mark up things like proteins or things like reagents and so forth. And we're also starting to do some experiments with interactive figures, where instead of just getting a static figure, we have an application that has the underlying data, and it allows you to replot it, zoom in, manipulate the figure, and actually download the underlying data as well. This is not something we have live at the moment. It's only something we've done some sort of R&D on. So we've got this sort of transition from, you know, a static print facsimile to something that's much more like a database. And so what we're seeing, we're also actually seeing, incidentally, databases becoming a bit more journal-like. So databases are adopting things like peer review, for example, whereas before they tended not to. And so we're seeing, slowly but surely, the rise of a new generation of sort of hybrid products. So let me give you one example. It's one that we've been working on for a number of years now. This is called the Molecule Pages. It's a database that we created in collaboration with people at San Diego Supercomputer Center. And it contains information about several thousand proteins that are involved in intracellular signaling. And you can look at this in two ways. It's a review journal. That's one way of looking at it. This is content information commissioned from experts in the field. This particular one, her name unfortunately doesn't appear on the screen, but it's written by Kathy Below. And she's written about a very important protein called G protein alpha S. The content that she's provided, what she's provided, has been subject to anonymous peer review. Editors at Nature Publishing Group have put it through peer review, have worked with the reviewers and with Kathy to refine it and make sure this is correct. And it's archival and citable. This is going to be available in perpetuity. It has a DOI, a digital object identifier, which is a way of making online, particularly scholarly content, citable. It's heavily used in scholarly content. So it has a persistent, unique identifier. So it's formally citable. So in all the important aspects, it's a review journal. But actually, when you look at it, it kind of looks database-like. And actually, if you go further, you know, it has the content is continually updated, so it's a bit like a database in that way. The content is also highly structured, so you can query it in very specific ways. So now I'm looking at a particular transition between two states of this molecule, and I'm getting some information about it. And I can also view that information in lots of different ways. So I can look at it in a tabular way or in a graphical way like this. So you can think of this as either a very database-like journal or as a very journal-like database. And each of the realm journals and databases is sort of adopting attributes of the other, and the distinction between them is gradually becoming less clear and less important. So let me talk about peer review as well. So peer review, I mean, this is a controversial opinion, at least within publishing. I think peer review is sort of set to undergo something of a revolution. It doesn't mean that everything, every publication we see at the moment that uses peer review is going to come up with a fundamentally new model. But what we're seeing is a lot of experimentation with different models. And that's been enabled and inspired by the web. So already in the sort of traditional realm, already peer review means many different things to different publications. So at some, what I would obnoxiously call low-end journals, peer review is a staff editor reading through the paper and thinking, this looks okay, we'll accept it. At the high-end journals like Nature and others, there's a full anonymous peer review system managed by an editor but involving multiple external experts and multiple rounds of revision to the paper to improve it and make it suitable for publication. But I think what we're going to see is an even greater diversity of models being used. And experiments with peer review do go back many years, but there's been, in recent years, particularly in the last year or two, there's been a sort of a noticeable increase in the rate of experimentation. And I think stimulated in large part by concepts like openness and sort of wisdom of crowds, those kinds of ideas that have been inspired by what is going on elsewhere in the web. And so we see experiments like Biology Direct, which is a journal that has a particular model of open peer review, where the peer review process happens in public, in essence. We have the journal PLOS One that is launching next month, I believe, that uses traditional peer review, but then with post-publication commentary, so that the discussion and the review of the implications of that paper can continue on after publication. And we see, even traditional publications like Cell, for example, which is a very prominent biological journal, now enabling comments on the paper's post-publication. So I'm going to talk a little bit about an experiment we've been doing, or a trial at least that we've been doing. We ran an open peer review trial between June and September this year, so just at the end of last month it ended. Actually, alongside it, we ran a web debate with great contributions from people like Chris Anderson and one of my former colleagues at Nature, Charles Jennings. I really recommend you look at that if you're interested in peer review and in particular what some of the new technological developments are going to mean for it. But we ran this peer review trial at the same time. What we did was this. So authors submitting a paper to Nature, if it was accepted for review, so if it wasn't rejected outright, so if it was accepted for review, which is roughly a third of the papers that we receive, the author was given the option of having that manuscript posted online for open comment. At the same time, it would still go through the traditional anonymous peer review process. So all papers were still going through that, but optionally, at the author's discretion, the manuscript was posted online, and for a period of, a few weeks, anyone could post comments about it, and those comments were filtered and moderated by editorial staff at Nature. And then all of the comments, both the anonymous ones and the public ones, were taken into account by the editor in making their decision. So, and this is just a screenshot from one comment that was posted in response to a paper. So we haven't got all the results in from that, because even though the trial's ended, not all of the papers have had final decisions made on them as to whether they've been accepted or not. So some of them are still going through further revisions and decisions. But I can give you a kind of a feel for the kinds of experience we had. So in total, 72 papers went through that system. That was somewhere between 5 and 10% of all of the papers accepted for review at that point. So it's a small minority of scientists who were willing to put their paper through that, but it was actually completely in line with what we'd expected. We did some little surveys ahead of time, and it was very much in line with that. I think, it was quite nice that it was across a broad range of subject areas. There weren't any particular subject area. We thought, well, maybe all the physicists would be happy, but the biologists weren't, because that's what people tend to assume, but that wasn't really the case. In total, there were 99 comments, so there was only about less than 1.5 comments per paper. About half the papers didn't get any comments at all. Some of them got really substantial ones. You know, here's an example, and there were substantial discussions on a few of the papers. But some comments were useful and others weren't. But as far as I'm aware at this stage, none of the public comments actually influenced the decision whether or not to publish the paper. So, you know, it's early days. I think there was a relatively low degree of participation. There was questions.
What was the mechanism by which other people in the field would be made aware that this was a big
Yeah, so we had, I mean, we were promoting quite heavily through our, you know, our usual sort of channels. For example, we send out email alerts whenever new issues of journals come out, and we were alerting people. You could also sign up for email alerts for the peer review. So if you're in some particular subject area, you would be alerted that a new manuscript had been published in that subject area. So we did our best to tell people about it. We're now actually in the process of just surveying authors to find out the authors who participated in this to find out what they think and did they get anything out of it. And the findings will be published in Nature at some point as soon as we've got all the information together. So we haven't decided yet, until we get all that information together, what we're going to do. Are we going to continue this? Are we going to try something different? Are we going to stop for now? We haven't decided that yet. So this slide is really just about an extreme example of kind of experiment with peer review, and it's a proposal at the moment, not something that's working as far as I understand anyway, but it's a proposal by some guys at Los Alamos, where they're doing some of the most interesting work in sort of information and library science, and it's a proposal to fully automate the process of peer review, basically. So the proposal is that it would work with an institutional repository, which is, you know, a database where academics at a particular institution deposit all of their manuscripts. And the idea is it will accept a manuscript, it will then read through the author list and the references, and it will do a kind of social network analysis to try and determine which other academics are likely to know something about this paper but are not so closely affiliated with the authors, such as, you know, being co-authors, that there's likely to be a conflict of interest. It then automatically emails copies to those reviewers, who then score the manuscript. So all they're doing is scoring it. They're not doing anything. You know, that leaves out a huge chunk of peer review, which is actually an iterative sort of improvement of the paper, making it better and making it suitable for publication. But you're leaving out a big part of what peer review actually does. But on the other hand, it's a hugely cheaper system to run. So, you know, because you haven't got an editor for making those decisions. And so for some types of content, it may be optimal. So I just think it's an intriguing idea. One of the most important questions that's come up is, should things be reviewed before they're published, or should they be reviewed after they're published? You know, so is it filter then publish, or is it published then filter? And of course, the web, you know, famously the web allows the latter, right? So in the paper world, we were constrained by how much we could print on dead trees, whereas in the web world, we can in principle put it all out there and allow post-publication filtering. And that's sort of quite a controversial issue, because some people think we should make the most of the web and use that approach. Other people think that, you know, that actually, you know, no one's got the attention to spend looking through all of this morass, and we should stick with the way we're doing it, which is to filter things first before we put them up. I want to talk a little bit about blogging, about scientific blogging, because it's sort of related to peer review a bit. So, and blogging is in many ways quite similar to publishing papers, although it's massively quicker, right? So, you know, you post your ideas, you cite your sources, and you hope that it contributes somehow to our collective understanding. So in that sense, it's sort of quite related to academic publishing. But of the many, many millions of blogs in the world, as far as we've been able to ascertain, only a few hundred are by scientists writing about science. So scientific blogging is really, really a minority activity. And some of the best ones are on science blogs, so that's why I put this screenshot up. And I think it's for two main reasons. One is that scientists don't get credit from their funding agencies, critically, for blogging. They get credit for publishing in peer-reviewed journals, particularly good peer-reviewed journals. You know, they tend to not spend a lot of time doing things that they don't get credit for. And also, going back to my earlier point, a lot of scientists are horrified by the idea of publishing things that haven't been through peer review. And of course, blogs are peer reviewed, but they're peer reviewed after the fact, right? You publish, and then they're reviewed through comments and other blogs linking to you and talking about what you said, not before. And that upsets a lot of scientists, and a lot of science editors and publishers as well. But I really think scientific blogging will take off, just as it seems to. I mean, to the best of my understanding, in law and economics, even though I'm not expert in either of those areas, but things I've seen have led me to believe that it's more prominent in those domains and in science. You know, because blogging is a remarkably efficient way of exchanging ideas, and ultimately that's what it's all about. But the incentives will need to change, or maybe the generation needs to change before that will really become mainstream in science, I think. So here's an interesting site. It's actually created by a colleague of mine, Ewan Ady. So Postgenomic is a site. It's a little bit like all-consuming, if you know that, in books, right? So all-consuming aggregates blog comments about books, and this aggregates blog comments about scientific papers. So this trawls a few hundred scientific blogs, a few hundred scientific blogs we know about, and it looks for links to academic sites. And then it aggregates things together that are about the same paper, so you can see, you know, what are the hot papers, what people have said about them. And, you know, in a sense, this kind of service is turning the scientific blogosphere, small though it may be, into a kind of post-publication peer review system, because it's pulling it all together for you for particular papers. So let me talk a bit about e-science. So I've actually just come from an e-science meeting at Johns Hopkins that took place over the weekend. And e-science really is the notion that information technology is changing not only the way that science is communicated, which is what I've been speaking about up to now, but the way that science is done. And I mean, there's a few different aspects to this, and there's no way I can go through it all, but just to give you a flavour of some of them. Science, especially biology in recent years, has been going through a massive transition from effectively a cottage industry model where within one lab you have somebody who collects the data, someone who analyses it, someone who drives the insight, writes up the paper, and you've got every stage of the process happening within one lab, small group, to a sort of industrial scale where you've got much more people, many more people involved and a much higher degree of specialization. So probably the best known examples would be the genome sequencing initiatives, where these big groups, multinational groups, they just specialized in sequencing the genomes and really did process level work on analyzing and trying to interpret what it means, right? They just wanted to sequence the genome, put it out there, largely for other people to work on. And you do see this in other areas as well. You see it particularly with some of the big projects funded by what are known as NIH glue grants in the States. So the Alliance for Cellular Signaling was a group that actually we've worked with on who have been working on very large-scale biology, looking at the internal signaling mechanisms of cells. A similar group called the Cell Migration Consortium, another one called the Consortium for Functional Glycomics. Those are three groups actually we've worked with them all who are doing kind of bit large-scale biology in which many, many labs are collaborating together. There's a high degree of specialization between the labs, and also really critically important, the output, the data they gather, they're being very open with it, okay? And they're actually, the funding they're getting is on condition that they're very open with the data and they throw it out there for other people to use and are not proprietary about it. Another example that's privately funded is the Allen Brain Atlas. So this is Paul Allen's investment in looking at the gene expression in the mouse brain, recently completed an entire atlas of, every mouse gene, essentially every mouse gene and its expression pattern in the brain. He funded that to be, a public resource that people can go in and use, so you don't have to replicate those experiments. You can see where each gene is expressed. And the web, of course, enables that kind of global collaboration. It enables big groups to come together, multinational groups, because the communication is much easier between them as a result of the web. But it also enables you to do things like the Allen Brain Atlas, which is to create an enormous data set and just put it out there for the world to use. And you don't have to really worry about who's going to come and use it. Put it up on the web and anyone can. But once again, the sort of the incentives provided haven't really caught up. The incentives within science haven't caught up. So you really only see it in these big groups that are set up and funded specifically to do that. So when you look at science, as I said before, you only get credit really for writing up a paper and publishing in a peer-reviewed journal. You don't get explicit credit for gathering exquisite data. You don't get explicit credit for creating some genius algorithm that allows somebody else to make a discovery. It's the person who makes the discovery who gets the credit. And it's really always been that way in science. I mean, Albert Einstein is more famous than Albert Michelson, who provided some of the data that went into his ideas. Hannes Kepler is more famous than Tycho Brahe, who provided the data for his ideas. But that's not to say that people who gather data or make those other sort of supporting work to eventually finding, making those discoveries, don't deserve any credit at all. They do deserve credit, and the current incentive systems really don't provide that to an adequate degree, in my opinion. And that sort of explains why you don't see much open collaboration at the small scale, right? Rather than these big projects that are funded specifically with the idea of promoting this kind of collaboration. But there are a few exceptions. So one is Open Wetware, which is basically a bunch of biologists that are using MediaWiki, the obviously the software that powers Wikipedia. It is John Wilbanks. He was clearly giving a talk. Oh really? Okay. So and he's now executive director of Science Commons, of course. So this is a bunch of biologists who are putting all their activities on this wiki. Okay. And I'll show you another example as well, which is Useful Chem. So this is an example from chemistry, a very similar example. Okay. And so these are examples of scientists doing their science. You know. All of their science, their triumphs and their failures, their brainwaves and their bombs, all in public. Okay, so they're sort of letting it all hang out. They're doing what Jean-Claude Bradley at Drexel University calls, open notebook science or no insider information. And this is, this shouldn't be strange, but it is actually revolutionary in science. This isn't what scientists typically do. They're actually very proprietary about their data often and about what they're doing. And they don't want to tell people in advance what experiments they're doing because if they fail, it's kind of embarrassing, right? And in fact, I mentioned earlier on the Alliance for Cellular Signaling, and a senior member of that consortium, that very big research group, described what they were doing, which was also very open, as like doing science in the nude, which kind of captures the vulnerability that they feel by kind of exposing themselves to potential criticism and embarrassment because what they do might not always be perfect. And it's a bit like, I don't know about other people, but when you blog for the first time, it's kind of like, opening yourself up. It's a little bit like that. You're not used to it initially, and it takes a little while. And they also, as I said, don't always benefit personally from doing that, even though it may be for the common good. So another characteristic of e-science is use of open and unambiguous identifiers to identify scientific entities. I'm a big fan of some of the stuff that Clay Shirky and actually David here talks about in terms of ontology is overrated. I think that's absolutely right. But in this sort of small scale, this small way, some of the sort of common identifiers or controlled vocabularies for scientific entities can be really powerful, right? So in chemistry, actually, the dominant identifier for chemical structures are CAS numbers, and they're sort of owned by the American Chemical Society and are rather proprietary. So you find people coming up with alternatives. So an alternative that's been worked on and proposed is INCHI, which is the International Chemical Identifier. And one of the nice things about the INCHI, they're enormously long things, a bit unwieldy, but one of the nice things is you can compute them from the structure. And so this is actually a really nice application from Peter Murray Rusk Group in Cambridge, where you can draw in this little jar wrap, you can draw the chemical structure you're interested in. You hit search, it converts that into an INCHI, and it does a Google search for the INCHI string, and we'll find documents that are about that, which I just think is a really neat example of how you can, use those identifiers, use existing kind of web services that are out there to help you really zero on any information you're looking for. I don't have a slide on it, but one of the other really interesting aspects of e-science is the use of monitoring networks. So, particularly monitoring the environment, the soil, the air, the water. And I think one of the most interesting sort of implications of that is that you can potentially get citizen participation in science. So people are familiar with SETI at home, which is about providing compute cycles for making discoveries. But one of the things that actually David mentioned earlier on that we held this thing called Science Food Camp in the summer, and one of the subjects that we discussed there was could you get this was actually from Richard Newton at Berkeley, who said could you get people to have atmospheric sensors in their mobile phones and transmit the information back about pollution or oxygen levels or temperature or whatever back to a central point and thereby have a much more powerful monitoring network than you can get any other way, but also I think importantly sort of socially get people actually directly engaged in science. I'll skip through that one. Okay, last bit, gratuitous bit on Second Life. So I'm going to finish off now, but I always love to sort of finish my talks with something about Second Life. And I was trying to think of a link, and I just had to admit this is completely gratuitous. But I love Second Life. So I just wanted to sort of finish off with a little talk about some of the... Hi, people in Second Life. I love you all. Thanks. So there's some fantastic science-related stuff going on in Second Life. And I think, Second Life for me is kind of like, it's as exciting as the early days of the web in terms of, where is this going to go? You've probably all known about the Space Flight Museum, the Schizophrenia House. I mean, there's some really fantastic stuff going on there. So we're starting to...
Could you expand on that just a little bit?
Sure. Okay. So you want me to talk about what they are?
Or? Yes.
Okay. So
I don't know what they are. So.
Okay, fine. Yeah, sorry. The Space Flight Museum... I mean, you really need to see these things to kind of appreciate them. But the Space Flight Museum basically has, you know, full-scale virtual replicas of, I think, every manned spacecraft there's ever been. I could be wrong about that, but certainly a lot of them. It has a kind of a display that's a kind of a model of the solar system that you can set to any date you choose. You can climb into one of the rockets. I think it's the Gemini rocket, but again, I could be wrong, and launch it up into space. And up in space, they also have a display that you can walk around in a model of the space shuttle in orbit. You know, so this is something where you can go in and understand manned spaceflight by actually sort of immersing yourself and sort of seeing it, as it were, for real, but not for real. The Schizophrenia House is a house in Second Life that was created to help carers and families and friends to understand what schizophrenia sufferers are going through. And you can walk through the house in sort of ordinary mode, where it's very benign and normal, and then you can sort of walk through it in schizophrenia mode, which helps you to understand what this kind of environment might feel like to a schizophrenic. You know, seemingly benign bits of writing on the wall suddenly say outrageous, violent things. An ordinary floor will turn into sort of stepping stones across some sort of psychedelic clouds. You know, so you can immerse yourself in the kind of world that schizophrenics feel, and reach a much deeper understanding of what it's like for them. There's just a couple of examples. There's lots of other great stuff going on. So we actually just bought an island. So this is very bare at the moment because we're still terraforming it. This photo was sent to me over the weekend by one of the guy at Electric Sheep who's terraforming it for us. So this is Second Nature, which is our island. I don't know. Can anyone guess what the structure is here?
Water?
It's a water molecule, yeah, of course. So here's the oxygen. Here are the two hydrogens. We're hoping to get a little electron spinning around each of the hydrogens. We're not going to have the 8 electrons going around the oxygen because that's going to be too much. But we're going to be doing some sort of scientific-related stuff on there. And we've got some quite exciting plans, but some of which are still too early to be able to describe in any detail. But the first thing that we've done, this is really just for fun. This is something called M4, which is the Magical Molecular Model Maker. So it kind of looks like a bubblegum machine, but what it'll do is it'll make you structures of molecules, right? So what it does is you ask it for a molecule, it goes off to the web to PubChem, which is the database we described earlier. It retrieves the 3D structure. They don't have many 3D structures, it's mostly a 2D database, but they have some 3D structures, and then it will generate the structure for you. This is a molecule. Does anyone know what this is? This is ATP, which is the energy store of the cell. So that's just our first little kind of foray into, you know, I mean, God knows if this is going to be scientifically useful, but until you try it out, you don't know, do you? So I hope I've shown that the web is changing not only science communication, but also science itself. And in fact, I think web pioneers, particularly the open source software hackers, share a common academic ethic with scientists, or at least the more idealistic scientists. And, you know, in that sense, the web is bringing back to science the sort of the greater sense of its original purpose, which is the collective pursuit of knowledge for the common good. And I think as these sorts of things show, I think the web also makes science even more fun. Thanks very much.
Well, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Not all scientific journals or organizations or institutions are embracing the web with the enthusiasm that nature is. Why is nature the exception here? What's going on there that makes it?
I honestly don't know. I mean, you know, the question for me is why the hell aren't all the other ones doing it? I mean, I have my boss Annette Thomas, who's the managing director of Nature Publishing Group, is extremely enthusiastic about the power of the web to really, you know, facilitate scientific communication and accelerate research. And that's what we feel our job is, right? We're a scientific communication company. We're not necessarily a journal publisher. And it's our job to help scientists communicate better with each other and with the public at large. And if we're not making full use of the web and pushing scientists to make better use of it, then we're not doing our jobs properly. I mean, So I suppose, you know, it's the support from my bosses is one of the reasons. And we've got a good collection of very passionate people in the company who really believe in this strongly. I skipped over the slide, but Declan Butler, one of our journalists, has done some amazing stuff with. He did some avian flu mashups with Google Earth, for example, for which he's just won a publishing award. You know, he's one of the sort of leading thinkers in this area as well about how you can use the web in science. So, I mean, I don't know. We've got some great people who I believe get it. You'd need to ask the other companies why they're not doing similar things.
Do you sense much dissatisfaction among the scientists with the current model of publishing? You say they're not contributing to some of these experiments, like your open peer review or these repositories. But is that because they're happy with the current mode, or is it for some other reason?
Do I need to repeat the questions? I don't know whether I should be repeating questions or whether they're all talking about. No, okay, fine. I think it varies enormously. Some people are deeply unhappy, no question about it. And, you know, we hear from them all the time. You know, so there's some people who are very vocal and very unhappy. I think the majority of scientists, to be honest, I mean, my perception is they don't actually think about it that much. They get on with their research, and that's what they're interested in, that's what they do. I mean, scientists, I speak as a scientist, tend to be quite obsessive people, right? And so they're upset, and that's why they're so good at what they do. And I'm not sure they spend that much time thinking about should publication system be better, for example, or for that matter, how can I make better use of the web? They want to do their next experiment, get their next paper out. That's my perception. Of course, that's a huge generalization, and there are exceptions, and there are people who believe passionately the system is broken, and they're trying to fix it.
We have a question from Oxford.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Timo. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, this is Ralph Schroeder here at the Oxford Internet Institute. I'm just wondering, you mentioned among the negative things the disincentives to scientists, but you didn't really mention any other negative things. Can you maybe talk about some negative things about what nature is doing, or potentially negative things? By that I mean, or what I have in mind rather, is, for example, that the communication channels that scientists use are becoming rather, or might become rather, diffuse, and this might lead to a kind of attention diffusion as well, so that scientists don't necessarily know what to look at anymore, what the most prestigious or most urgent things for them to look at are. Do you see that danger at all? Or I'm generally positive towards the developments, but I'm just wondering, do you see that downside as well?
So when you say diffuse, do you mean that there's just too much information out there? Is that what you're getting at? Because that's certainly one of the challenges.
What I mean is that there are just so many different channels for people to look at, and they might no longer recognize what the most important or what the most prestigious are. So, I suppose you could see it as information overload. You could also see it as if channels, not necessarily nature, but the various outlets that nature is kind of fostering, become very diffuse and proliferate, then people will no longer have a good sense of what they should look at first and most urgently.
Clearly, as more different things come out, there's only a certain amount of attention to go around. So my interpretation of your question is, when you've got things like not only journals and an increasing number of journals, but you've got blogs and you've got institutional repositories and funder repositories and you've got, God knows how many other, databases and so on and so forth. How the hell do you know where to get the most important and urgent information, as you described it? I think that clearly is a challenge. I mean, actually, for us, it's also an opportunity because we don't just want to proliferate and give people more choice. We also want to provide people with a means to sort of consolidate and aggregate and filter that information, and that's something we spend a great deal of time thinking about. So how can we provide people with the means to find to go to the most interesting, important stuff? If we can go and find it and we understand something about their interests, how can we direct them and help them make better use of their time? Does that answer your question?
Yes, this is Jennifer DeBeer speaking.
Hi.
Hi, I'm with the OII as well. Just a question, though. I'm really worried. Well, my question is, with regard to your definition of open access, why do you choose to then exclude these recent developments as something being outside of what the open access movement is focusing on?
I understand the question. Thanks for that. I don't. I don't. I'm not criticizing open access and those principles. What I'm saying is, you know, as narrowly defined, and this is probably more an issue within the publishing industry than elsewhere, as narrowly defined, you know, just concentrating. I'm talking, when I talk about open access in that context, I'm talking about, you know, the issue of, you know, does the money flow through the reader or the author? Does who should be putting what in what repository, and what should the embargo period be, and what should it not be, and those kinds of discussions. And I think certainly we as publishers, and perhaps some people in the scientific community, are getting very, very bogged down in those kinds of discussions, which are not unimportant. It's just that there's much bigger and more important issues going on around that. Now, you know, as it happens, I think all of the projects I work on, I'm trying to think of an exception and I can't, are open access in the sense that, you know, they're freely available for people to use and they don't use the subscriber business model. But, you know, say the molecule pages that I described earlier on, for example, are that kind. But the fact that they're open access, I don't think is the most interesting thing about them. I think there's some other much more interesting things about them. I mean, in a sense, I'm taking it as a given.
Yeah, okay, but thanks for clarifying that then, because I think that kind of went unsaid.
Thanks.
Thanks.
As you're describing the barriers to collaboration and scientists working together in a more open environment, I hear a couple of different elements that are contributors to those barriers, such as, you know, on the personal level, there's psychology and definitions of professionalism. There seems to be some cultural issues. There's also, you've identified funding, and also potentially the infrastructure of how these labs are actually physically are set up in terms of their funding, their physicality, and all that kind of stuff. Which of those are most amenable to change, and also would make the biggest difference in terms of opening up some of the possibilities for collaboration and sharing?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know. I you know, it's very difficult. I mean, there are clearly kind of social barriers, as you correctly said, you know, so they're just what people are used to and you know, what the social norms are and expectations are. I think those are very difficult to change. I did mention the funders a couple of times, and I don't mean to sort of pick on them, but I actually do think they're the ones who actually have the ability to, you know, in one stroke kind of change people's behavior, because they're the sources of the money. So when you talk about funders mandating, you know, self-archiving, for example, you know, that's why I say, you know, authors left to their own devices, many of them, but most of them, won't necessarily choose to provide their work as open access, because they don't seem to care that much about it. But if the funder mandates it, then they will. So I think the funders are in a very strong position. In some respects, the journals are in a strong position as well. So an example there is, you know, we and other journals will require, for example, that if you report on a nucleotide sequence, a gene sequence, for example, you have to have put it into GenBank or you know, part of the GenBank system, one of the databases that makes up the GenBank system, and provide us with the accession number before we'll consider publishing your paper. You know, so you know, that's kind of a requirement of publication. So in those kinds of contexts as well, journals are in a strong position. Funders are as well. I think in some cases institutions might be, but I think funders, in my opinion, but you know, I don't work at a funder, so it's easy for me to say, are probably in the strongest position of all to change behavior anyway.
I really liked what you had to say about databases becoming journals, and I was wondering if you could scope that out a little bit more, because I can imagine that if, for example, over the next 5 years, all the people who are published through Nature, they're not just publishing a work through Nature, but they're essentially donating their research, because these things will be dumped into the database, and then Nature can basically pull from everyone's collective research to extrapolate and do things that people couldn't do individually. So that it seems like Nature's, you can call it private wealth or individual wealth, is certainly growing in a way that it didn't have a capacity for before. Like, you become a storage place for research. Mm-hmm. And so there could be incentive for people to publish through Nature, because they want to give, in physical terms, to your database, but they also want to be part of that collective. I'm just wondering if you could scope out, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years, how you think something like that will develop. Are you...
I don't know. I mean, I agree with the kind of vision you spelt out. I mean, you know, and it's something we think about quite a lot, and it's an area that we're working on as well. I mean, in some of the things that I've shown you, also some of the things that are still kind of, you know, behind the scenes, going on behind the scenes. I mean, I don't know how it's going to pan out. I mean, for me, you know, we don't have some kind of grand plan of like in 10 years' time, we're going to have this kind of system, because there's too many imponderables, right? And in particular, the sort of social pressures and the social norms and all that kind of stuff. And I just find, you know, I just think it's impossible to foresee exactly how people are going to use these systems. So, you know, what we're trying to do is do some things that we think are interesting and that will have benefit, and see where they go. And that's sort of what I'm talking about here. So I'd like to believe in the kind of vision that you spelled out there. Is that going to happen? I have no idea. But we're trying to do some things to help make that happen, and we'll see where they go. Question here.
It seems like open source software publishing has a very similar model to what you're trying to move towards. Have you looked at the model of Diamond, for instance, minus Torvalds controls accepting work into the body of the Linux kernel, which seems roughly analogous to Nature's role as a journal. Have you looked at this analogy much?
I've thought about that analogy. I once wrote a very tongue-in-cheek piece about it, actually, that I think people would find in a wider network. But I kind of, in some ways, I see science as an enormous open source project, right? You know, and each publication is a kind of a patch to the kernel, and contributing something to it, hopefully. And, you know, and so we move on, and so it gets better, and our knowledge base grows. So yes, I agree with that analogy. And that's kind of what I mean, I guess, when I say that the, you know, open source software, you know, that sort of hacker ethic, actually has its root in the same, from the same academic roots that that science shares with it as well. Does that answer your question, or do you want me to expand further?
I think that's as much as I can say without asking for a very in-depth
okay. Analysis. We can talk later if you like. Okay. Yeah.
For filtering after publication, what are the what are the safeguards against junk science?
Well, that's exactly the worry. Okay, so. And I think, the answer is that you have to set people's expectations. You have to not mislead them as to what they're reading. Okay, so you know, that's exactly the argument. People say, well, it's very unsafe to put stuff out there that hasn't been peer reviewed because it might be wrong. Now, the reality is, stuff that has been peer reviewed might be wrong. Okay, but there's a different level of certainty involved. At least it's been through a filtering process. I think the problem is that traditional peer review, when properly done, is extremely labor-intensive, right? And as the volume of information grows, you can't, I don't think it's scalable, right? You can't have, you know, everything being peer-reviewed to that level or in that way. And so the question is, you know, are there alternative models? And, you know, so one of the alternative models is actually to put the stuff out there and allow, you know, use this wisdom of crowds type of approach. And by wisdom of crowds, I don't mean, I think there are some different things going on when people say wisdom of crowds. It's a kind of, there's a stock market wisdom of crowds, right, which is the average behavior of lots and lots of people. And then there's the wisdom of crowds, which is the sort of the Jimmy Wales view of Wikipedia, which is it's basically self-selected people who are coming in and doing something, but it's not a large group of people necessarily. You know, I think you could look at models of peer review around, you know, instead of you know, forcing, essentially, you know, two or three referees to look at this and comment on it within 2 weeks and send it back, put it out there and allow whoever's interested, whenever they are interested, to come in and comment on it, and then use that information somehow, if they rate or comment on it or whatever, to then help other people who might be interested find it, or to hide it if it turns out to be junk, right? So there are, you know, that, there isn't a safeguard against junk science anyway, actually. There are greater or lesser levels of protection, and what people have to do in those sort of scenarios is just understand what they're looking at, right? Yeah, so, you know, what's been done and what hasn't been done. And I think as long as you do that, it's not too dangerous, but you just have to be very careful not to mislead people.
Two quick questions. Since we're not wasting any more trees, I don't understand why does it have to be either or? Why can't we have either two databases or a mark next to the paper? You know, that peer reviewed, pre-publication reviewed, or post-publication reviewed. And the other one is, do you foresee scientists divided into sort of aggregates of science, aggregate scientists and regular scientists, sort of like the way she was talking about the Nature, where its editor would not be well versed in a specific part of the science enough to be able to aggregate, similar research into one article, and therefore you need a scientist aggregator.
So a scientist who would do the job of aggregating, you mean?
Yes.
Right. So the first question was about why not publish every version of, you know, so the submitted version, the version that was then revised during peer review, and then the final published version.
But why not? You seem to suggest that it's only possible to have either the fight is between one or the other. I can't see why not the ability, since we're not wasting any trees, to have both, you know, peer reviewed and not peer reviewed, either in two different databases.
Oh, sure, yeah.
The same database, just with a little mark that this one has and this one has not been.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. You know, so in some cases you might, so there will be peer reviewed and there will be unpeer reviewed stuff. And I'm kind of what I'm saying is also there will be other models of peer review that might involve peer review after publication. So, you know, in some sense it's not peer reviewed to begin with and it becomes increasingly peer reviewed with time. Yeah, so I agree with that. I didn't quite understand the issue. So you're saying that the second question was to do with scientists do, as I understand, specialize in aggregating information. I don't quite follow that. So if I've understood correctly, maybe this is what it's about. I mean, I think there are. I visited yesterday the National Center for Biotechnology Information, the NCBI, which runs databases like PubMed and PubChem, which we were talking about earlier. And they have a fantastic system called Entree, which basically allows you to query across these databases, creates links for you across the databases. Actually, Jim Ostell, who runs the sort of technical team that manages that, gave a great talk at the science conference I was at Johns Hopkins over the weekend, and shows how you can make discoveries, right? So you can make discoveries without doing bench science, right? You can go into the database and you can find stuff, right? Now, it doesn't happen nearly enough, because scientists kind of, a lot of them don't realize that you can do that. But it's happening increasingly as systems like Entree get more user-friendly, for example, as scientists get more web and computer savvy, particularly biologists who tend to sort of lag people like astronomers in that area. And what tends to happen is you might make a provisional kind of interesting discovery or indication, or an indication through the database, and then you'll run away and do some experiments that are aimed specifically at trying to resolve whether or not that's a fact or an artifact in the data. So you certainly do get people who are who use existing data and try and pull it together to try and make discoveries. But there are very few people who just do that. In fact, I don't know of any examples of people who just do that, but putting together information to try and synthesize new findings that way without doing any kind of experimental research. Does that answer your question?
Partially. I was more using the models that she was using before, like in Nature, where if somebody finds the same phenomena, to use a primitive term, in insects, and somebody else finds the same phenomena in primates, to then aggregate it together.
Sure. Well, I don't think, I don't know of anyone who specializes in that kind of thing, other than maybe, science editors and journalists to some degree, who are looking across broad swathes and trying to bring together interesting ideas. But of course, scientists all the time are writing review articles, surveying areas, and sometimes they span different domains. You have scientists working across different disciplines. I mean, engineering and science is a particularly, productive and interesting one at the moment in terms of synthetic biology, for example. So, you get that kind of thing. But in terms of people who specialize in finding something that's conceptually similar in one area than the other, I'm not aware of people who do that. Certainly some people will be better at it than others, but I'm not aware of people who just specialize in doing that.
But the gene ontology people do. And there are other examples. The interdisciplinariness of things is, I think, behind all this, and it isn't. You don't know what it's safe to ignore in my experience.
Yeah. Well. So. I mean. Of course, the gene ontology. The gene ontology goes across huge swathes of biology, and it's an ontology, right, for covering cellular processes, subcellular localizations, and something else.
The
sort of three main categories. So, sure, that involves a lot of people working across a lot of different domains. But I guess my point is that they're creating an ontology. They're not directly creating insight. I mean, that can be used to then tie things together, maybe. So if you were to mark up a particular finding with a gene, a particular concept in the gene ontology and another one over here, that might help you to bring those two together and make that synthesis. The gene ontology project itself is not doing that. It's creating the ontology.
I was more asking if you see the science going that way as the things get a little more complicated to aggregate together for just editors, where they really have to be scientists.
I don't know whether that's going to become more or less important. I really don't know. I haven't thought about it enough. It's an interesting question.
I was wondering about the barriers to change, and I was hoping you would comment on the funding system. the revenue model for Nature, and also the way that funding is handed out to the scientists and all peer review and all that. Just how do you imagine it evolving to focus on these new things that you're talking about today with the collaborative e-based systems? How can you imagine the money system evolving to support that thing so it becomes
the main? I don't know. I mean, so our projects, as I said, they're mostly, in fact, I think, in my department, entirely kind of open and free to use. And we rely at the moment on a combination of, you know, commercial sponsorship and advertising, and in some cases some grant funding as well. It may be that for some of our services we might adopt a kind of, you know, a freemium model where the basic service is free. You know, some of our social software applications, for example, the basic service is free, but you can pay for some premium services, so a la Flickr, for example. But I don't know, but in global context as to, you know, what will happen to science funding and the way the money's divvied up, I don't know. I mean, it's not, you know, I think these are sort of, these are things that will ultimately be up to the funders, but what I hope we can do, you know, what I focus on is trying to create things that are genuinely useful to scientists, and in a kind of belief, possibly a completely misguided belief, that if they're genuinely useful for people, we will find some way of sustaining them economically, right? So, and you know, whether it's through charging people to use it, whether it's through advertising, whether it's through kind of governmental funding, I don't spend a lot of my time thinking about, you know, how will that funding system change. It's going to have to change, and, you know, you see certain trends, for example. You know, so one of the great big issues at the moment is how databases are funded in science, right? So, you know, because science projects are typically funded by, you know, you apply for a project grant, you get money for 3 years or whatever it might be, you go and do the experiment, and when it runs out, right, you stop that and you can do something else. But if it's a database, it's a piece of infrastructure, you can't just stop it because people are depending on it now, right? And so it can't really be funded in the same way. At the same time, you have to compete for money like everyone else. You can't just be given, you know, money without question each year to continue it because people are depending on the service. And so things like that, you know, I know NIH are thinking very carefully about how issues like that should be dealt with. I don't know quite how they're going to resolve it. I mean, I think there are going to be various solutions. There isn't one magic bullet. How is sort of science funding going to change to support our island in Second Life? You know, just to take a slightly sort of tongue-in-cheek example, I don't know, to be honest. And at the moment, we're just at too early a stage of saying, you know, can we do something useful first of all, and then we'll worry about how to fund it. Which is, you know, and I can do that because we have a successful journal business, right? You know, so I can do that off the back of that business and explore, right? So I'm in a very lucky, fortunate position that we can experiment with things like that, but we have to make good use of that opportunity and try and come up with something that's genuinely useful, and then hope that we will find some way of supporting it, and hope, for example, if where necessary, that the funding agencies, you know, if that's appropriate, should wish to support it.
Your discussion today focused mostly on the flow of information within the scientific community. An area certainly ripe for some help would be the flow of information in and outside of the community. Classic example would be the science of climate change and how consensus within the community was terribly misconstrued outside of the community. What do you think the implications of moving into different research modules and different ways of sharing information might be for that?
So Nature actually has a twofold mission. One is to enable, that was established in 1869 when the journal was established. One is to enable scientific communication between scientists themselves, and the other is to enable communication between science and society at large. So it is something that we think about quite a lot. Traditionally we feel we do a lot as an organisation to provide reliable scientific information to society at large in terms of, you know, we have a free online news site, news@nature.com. We work closely with the media through our press office to make sure that there's reliable reporting of the science that we publish. But there's clearly more that we can do. I mean, you know, on climate change specifically, actually, we will be doing some stuff next year to sort of bolster that area. We'll be providing more information on that in that area. The things that I'm focused on are mainly to do with, as you say, communication within, among scientists. But I actually think, you know, things like Second Life actually can can spark people's imagination and get them engaged in the topic, because the venue and the kind of, you know, the idea of Second Life is kind of so interesting and whizzy, and kind of that you can actually start engaging people in scientific subjects who may not otherwise be engaged in it. And also, as I described earlier on with the sort of Schizophrenia House example, that you can actually really convey to people in a much more sort of visceral way certain concepts that might be hard to describe in, you know, in prose, for example. So, I don't know. I think there are, you know, all these new tools at our disposal should enable us to do a better job in that. Exactly how it's going to pan out, you know, we'll, as I say, we're just trying these things and we'll see.
I'm not sure how to put this pleasantly.
Put it unpleasantly.
Okay. So, if, and I'm not sure that's right, but if at the heart of Nature's business model is the value of the peer review that it manages, and if now we're seeing a world in which there are alternatives or supplements to peer review, doesn't that drive down Nature's value? And don't they worry? And also, the distribution, the increased accessibility of information outside of the people who own it and manage it. Don't those two things constitute threats to Nature?
Yep.
Okay.
So absolutely. I mean, I actually think that from a publishing industry perspective, my opinion is that developments in peer review are a more fundamental threat than the open access movement has ever been. Because, you know, all through the open access debates for the last sort of, you know, been particularly heavy during the last 2 or 3 years, there wasn't much kind of debate about, you know, well, peer review is here to stay and the publishers do it and we want them to continue doing it. I think there are a lot of reasons to think that peer review in its current model will stay around, you know, in some places. It's not going to go away altogether, and it has a lot of value. And it does actually work quite well for all its flaws. But with these alternative models, absolutely they're a threat. And that's why we need to be there experimenting with them and understanding them. I do believe, though, fundamentally that, you know, there is a role for publishers to play and will continue to be a role for publishers to play to help people find the information they want, right? As Ned says, more information that gets more complex, that becomes a more important role, not a less important role. Now, whether the current incumbents would be the best people to do that is, you know, we'll have to wait and see. And one of my jobs is to make sure that we're equipped to be able to add value in that environment, you know, and we'll see how it works out.
See if anybody actually got the last word.
Oxford says that they're all good.
Okay. No, we're good. We're good over here. Thanks.
Well, in that case, that was great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.